Good morning, I'm Tommy, I'm an alcoholic. All right, this is great. I got a call a couple of months ago to saying, you know, we've picked you to be one of our speakers. We don't know where you're going to be and on the program, but we want to let you know, we are considering you. And I was excited. And then I got a call a week later, and they said, we'd love for you to be the spiritual speaker, the Sunday morning speaker. And, my heart just dropped. But then I called Joe Curley up, and I said, I'm going to have to get spiritual the next couple of months. They speak, you know. And, we had a laugh about it. But the truth is, I don't know, Sunday morning speaker is traditionally a spiritual speaker. I mean, my story, you'd listen to my story, the spirituality in my life is, I just lived a life that I believed to be true. And that's what I base it on. It's not based on what you think anymore. It's not based on what I think you think anymore. It's based on what I've learned from my experience, and I try to apply it. And when I take that approach, everything seems to work well. I don't know. I grew up in South Boston, Massachusetts. And, it was a great place to grow up. Some exciting characters. People see the movie Good Will Hunting or whatever, and, those kids would have got beat up every day, you know? the guys I grew up with were great guys, but, it was nuts. But I'm the youngest of six kids, some older brothers and sisters, and I grew up, I had my family life, and the life that really that I grew up in was on the street corner when I was a young kid. I couldn't wait to get out of the house, be with my friends, and that was really how I grew up. That was my family, those kids that I grew up with. But I would watch my older brothers and sisters, for me, there was no drinking really in my house. My father was a bartender. There was alcohol in the house. Maybe once in a while he'd play cards with his friends. I didn't grow up with that bad feeling around alcohol that a lot of people did. I didn't have the pain and the fear involved when someone came home drunk. There was nothing but good. I could nothing but equate good times to drinking. And so I didn't have, a lot of that stuff. So when I saw people drink, I couldn't wait to drink. I associated with good times. And the brother youngest to me is about 12, 13 years older than me. And I'd watch him, and he was just my hero when I was younger. He went to the Bruins games up in Montreal, and they'd take the road trips, and just they would go everywhere. He went to Super Bowl every year. He'd go to the Final Four every year. And he went to the Orange Bowl one year and didn't come back for 18 months. And I couldn't wait to live like that, that's what I was aspiring to be as a young kid. And so when it came time for me to take a drink, I had no reservations. And the first time that I really, I had a lot of first drinks, sips off some beers or whatever, but the first time that I really drank alcohol and it had effect on me, I was down in my friend's basement. His mother let us kind of build a club down there just so she knew where we were. And a lot of things happened down there, but I found his father's stash of peppermint schnapps. And there was all these empty bottles, and one of them was about a third full. And I drank some of it, and I realized I could drink some more. And I drank pretty much the whole thing. I passed it to him to drink, and he didn't want to have anything to do with it. He came from one of those homes where, his father would come home drunk and wake everybody up in the house up, and, oh, this is my house, that type of stuff. And he didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I drank the rest of it down. And I loved the effect. The first thing around it was just the warm feeling, that feeling of okay. And I remember it was like after school, and I went home to dinner that night, and I'm at the dinner table, I'm chatting up a conversation, and my father looked over me. We didn't talk at my dinner table, Irish Catholic family, we chew and screw. We just, eat real quick, and everybody goes to their neutral corners. And So instantly alcohol had an effect on me where it changed my behavior and something happened, and it wasn't a problem. Nothing happened that day, and And then I began to plan drunks, and they were around, you know, a special Friday night or, you know, school vacation, and, you know, it's like 12, 13 years old, something like that, and that was my relationship with alcohol at first. But besides all that, there was a lot of other craziness going on. I would leave my house, say, like, on a Friday after school or something, and I would, as soon as I was get out of the house, I'd be so excited, just to going down the corner, gonna be with my friends, and then just this fear would creep in. You know, what if I get into a fight with this guy? What if this would happen? What if this would happen? And then I would struggle between, you know, loving what I was growing up in, the insanity I was growing up in, and then the fear. And what I learned was, if I drank, that fear went away, and I began to use alcohol in that way. And trouble pursued, and I was thrown out of schools, and just the regular, like, you know, crazy stuff that happens. All the, you know, if you're one of those kids that are in trouble all the time, that's where I was. And when I was 13, I was drinking one night, and I think it was, I don't know, maybe February school vacation or something like that. I think it was like the first Saturday night, and I was staying over a friend's house, and I planned to be out all night drinking, and I carried a handgun that I got off of somebody when I was younger, and I was in Boston Public Schools, and I think I had a lot of fear, and I carried a handgun, and a friend of mine had this gun, he was holding it for me, and an argument broke out, and he pulled out that gun and shot me in the throat, right through my throat, and it was just, it was an awful experience, obviously, but just to kind of paint a picture of where I was at 13 years old, after being shot in the throat, my first reaction wasn't help. My first reaction was to try to control the situation. And he dropped that gun, and I remember I grabbed him and I threw him against the wall. He dropped the gun. I threw the gun in an alleyway. I told the other kid that was there not to say anything. And then the cops showed up, and I said, "Don't say anything." And that's where my mind was at 13 years old. Not help, call an ambulance, I've been shot, you know, blood is coming out of my throat, you know. And so without a drink, I'm nuts anyways, you know, without a drink. And but what happened out of that situation was, you know, I didn't tell anybody what happened. I'm in the hospital, my parents, you know, I have good parents, they just don't know what to do. And nobody knows what happened. A few days later, this one kid that I told not to say anything, he said something to somebody, and I said I knew I couldn't trust that kid, you know? And I was pissed. And but everybody was mad at me because I wouldn't say anything. And so here I am in this really traumatic situation, not being able to say what happened, everybody knowing what happened now, and now everybody being mad at me and not knowing how to deal with it. And it really screwed me up. And I withdrew for about 6 months, and I couldn't be around people, and, you know, I didn't know until sobriety that how much of an effect that had on me, and what it did to when I started drinking again, it came on with a vengeance, and I drank heavily after that point, and I will say I grew up with a bunch of guys. No one ever said, "I won't do this, I won't do that." Nobody ever said, "I won't put a needle in my arm, I won't do this." I mean, that's just what I grew up in. And so I drank, and I did a whole lot of other stuff, and it just tumbled and tumbled and tumbled. And but that stuff didn't make me alcoholic. I can look back and say, I can remember the times where I'd be going home, trying to sober up, and I would sit in these stairs around the corner from my house, and I would say, I just wish, because when I went home drunk, there was trouble. And I said, I just wish I didn't have to get as drunk tonight. And I'd try to sober up, and I'd say, you know what, tomorrow night I'm not going to drink as much. And tomorrow would come, drink just the same, same thing would happen. And it was those slow, small loss of values that were my values. Because the values that I had growing up were deranged anyways. But the ones that were important to me, the ones where I said, gee, I'm not going to do this, or maybe I'm going to try not to behave like this, and I would cross those lines, and it's the lines of my lines that I crossed that I began to have spiritual loss of values. And that's when I believe I crossed that line, and I was beginning to drink without my choice. You know, I put a drink in me, and who knows what was going to happen, and there would be more trouble and more problems, and And I was basically, I ended up being the kid most people thought I was going to be. High school dropout, selling drugs on a street corner. And, you know, nobody was surprised. I was on a corner one night, and I was waiting for some friends of mine, and a car pulled up, and it was three guys from my neighborhood. They were all in their early 20s. I knew they didn't drink anymore. These were guys that were nutty growing up, and they were well-respected, and it was, you know, it was a big sedan, big four-door Buick sedan, and, you know, my neighborhood, like, fast cars weren't, like, you know, the cars, the popular cars growing up. It was, like, the big four-door sedans with, like, the three-body trunks, you know, and so, like, this car pulled up, and, you know, these guys, they knew me, and they were talking to me, and, you know, one of them said, you know, you're a mess, and we've been hearing bad things, and they said, why don't you try coming to a meeting of AA with us? And I knew what AA was. Some friends of mine had been sentenced there, and I said, you know, I'm all set. And they were talking at me, and, you know, most people in my life had been talking at me at this point. I was always being talked at because of what I was doing. And I felt no different. These guys were talking at me about the things I was doing. And then something happened, and, you know, I've never heard anybody share anything like this, but in the back seat of this car, I noticed that there was like an army duffel bag, and I could see that there were guns in it. Now, these are three sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, early 20s, guys from the city, with a duffel bag full of shotguns and rifles. And so it drew my interest, you know? I just said, you know, what's with the guns? And he says, oh, don't, you know, those are mine. They're registered. I was just out on my boat shooting out on one of the islands. And now all of a sudden what they're saying about AA kind of seems interesting, you know? You know, guns, AA, yeah, I can, you know, I can see I can make this work. Now, that was 14 years ago. It was around October 1990. And a lot's happened between now and then. If there's any doubt in my life that God works through other people, you know, that took it away. And I look back on that. Nothing would have got through to me that day like a duffel bag full of guns, you know? And, you know, God can do for us what we can't do for ourselves. So that one thing made it okay for me to go to an AA meeting. And a few weeks later, I had taken a vicious beating one night, and this kid, like, kicked my head off a fire hydrant for, like, a half hour. And you know, it's just one of those beatings you remember the rest of your life. And it was something I did drunk, you know, something I had done. And I really couldn't complain about it. I was going to get him, but I couldn't really complain about it. And I called one of these guys up, and I said, hey, listen, do you think I can go to one of the meetings? And he told me where the meeting was. He said, meet me there. And I did, and I got a little buzz on, and I went down to the meeting. And the thing about the hook in Alcoholics Anonymous for me happened right away. My most favorite part of a meeting is watching the meeting being set up. When the people are talking with each other, just like before this meeting, people are communicating, hey, how is this, how is that, making eye contact. And for me, the first thing that I noticed about Alcoholics Anonymous was the absence of fear. I walked into a meeting, and I scanned the room. The coffee was being rolled out, the chairs were being set up, and there was such a lack of fear. Because I sensed it. I was a fear-based creature. I can sense it. I watch people. These guys, you know, it amazed me. And it was something that was very foreign to me. And I didn't have to hear what happened at that meeting that night. I didn't have to hear anybody's talk. What I witnessed just as the group interacting with each other sold me on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've never had a bad feeling about AA since. I know a lot of people that have come to AA under a lot of different circumstances. And I can say, you know, from the very first time I stepped my foot in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like it was a safe place. And I think that's the best thing that we can ask for. How we conduct ourselves in AA, you know, what we do here. You know, it's fun. It's great to be wild at a conference and loud and yell at stuff, but this has to be a safe place. Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous have to be a safe place for people to come and be welcomed. And it was for me. I heard three speakers that night. I can't really remember what they said, but I know they told what my life was like up until that point, and they told a lot more. And not one of them treated me like a kid. I was 16 years old, and not one of them treated me any different than I was just an alcoholic. These were all guys that were getting sober. They got sober at a real strong group in Salty. At the time, you'd have to get there at least a half hour early to get a good seat, and 300 people at least, and a lot of old-timers. It was the Wednesday night meeting to go to. It was the rebound group, and a lot of the people in the rebound group really didn't like the young guys coming to AA and talking about drugs, and they told them to go start their own meeting, and that's what happened. So it was a lot of young people who were alcoholics, who were also drug addicts, started their own meeting, and I got sober there. At first, they suggested I go to a detox, and I went to a detox, and the first day I got in the detox, it was funny. I met this kid who I could tell was a lot like me, and he was planning an escape, and we were up in New Hampshire, about an hour and a half away from Boston, and so I went around and took a collection for him. I said, listen, Bobby's going to take off, he's going to steal a car, you got any money for him? And I collected about 150 bucks, pocketed 100 of it, and I said, Bobby, here's 50 bucks from me to you, And he took a butter knife and stole somebody's car and took off, but I got sober out of that detox, and I went back to Salty, and I joined this group. They made me the coffee maker, and I was excited, and in Massachusetts we have our group meetings are mostly commitment meetings, which means our home group members get together and go out to your home group and put on the meeting, and then you come back and put on our meeting. We have less discussion meetings, a lot of stand-up commitment meetings, and so we would load up, four or five of these big sedans full of guys, and we'd meet for commitments, and we'd get together and be like, nobody's gonna drink tonight, we're gonna sober these guys up, and we'd take off and take over somebody's home group, and it was crazy, but it was running with a crowd. I ran with a crowd, and it was great. The guys that helped me get sober were tremendous. They loved me in the way that I needed to be loved, and they picked me up every day. They talked to me about sobriety. They talked to me about being a good son. They talked to me about how to mend things in my house. And one day my friend Sean picked me up, and he had two big coffees and gave me one, and he began to flip through the newspaper, and he said, "Do you see these pages right here?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "You know what's on them?" And I said, "I think so." He says, "They're jobs, buddy. You gotta get one." And I'm sick of buying you coffee every day. And and at home, my mother's saying to me every day, "Get a job, get a job, get a job." But I can't hear her. And that's what it was like. And but I will say that the 12 steps were less of a priority amongst a lot of these younger guys. They were really active. They were really committed to each other. They loved each other. But I can honestly say there wasn't one of them that could sit me down and walk me through the 12 steps. And I paid for it. My sobriety didn't go in the direction that it should have. Things got better just by being sober. But I felt that was enough, because that's all I was seeing. My life got better. I got better jobs. Better things happened. The Big Dig was just starting in Boston. I wanted to work on the Big Dig, and I did that. And I mentioned I was a high school dropout, and I met someone in AA who was going to this night school, high school program. I was going to get my GED, and I met this girl who was going to high school at night, and she said, "You know what? I just really want to get my high school diploma." And I said, "So do I." And I signed up for this program, and I'm a straight D F student, straights, there's no C's, there's no B's, and but they said, "You know what, you only really need a few classes," and I showed up, and I got a high school diploma, and it was one of those things in sobriety that nobody could take away. Nobody could earn it for me, and nobody could take it away. And I was really proud of myself, and I was building esteem. I was doing esteemable things. And life continued to get better. I was showing up in ways that I couldn't show up before. And but again, I can honestly say I was not working the steps. I would look at the steps, and I would talk about the steps with people, and I would do things like pray and meditate, you know. But by the time I'm getting down to prayer and meditation, you know, that step might as well say, you know, sought through morbid reflection, we see every flaw in our character and pursue to, you know, character assassinate ourselves. That's what that step might as well say to me without practicing the prior 10. And that's where I was at, and I was really stuck in AA. But I just, you know, I kept showing up, and people said, keep coming, keep going to meetings, and that's what I did. I started racing sailboats. I grew up, I learned how to sail when I was a kid at a sailing program in my neighborhood, and I met a guy in the program who wanted to race sailboats. He went and bought a sailboat, and me, him, and another guy in AA, we sailed it together. We traveled around, you know, Massachusetts Bay, and we raced in these regattas, and it was really tremendous, and I really fell in love with it, and it was really special to me. And you know, I love the ocean. I scuba dive, I sail, I'm like a porpoise, you know. I love the ocean. And I was traveling around, you know, Gull Lake, Michigan. We go out and sail, and you know, a few years of sobriety, I was out and racing in the nationals for the type of boat that I sail out in Milwaukee, South Shore Yacht Club, and having a great time. Sober a number of years, my life just couldn't have been better. And after a long day of racing, there was a cooler that had beers in it and soda and water, and I grabbed the water, and somebody said, grab me a beer, and I handed him a beer, and the thought just came to my mind, wouldn't it be nice to have a beer right now? You know, wouldn't it be nice to just be able to sit back with the boys and have a couple of brews? And you know, it's the thought that crowds out all others, you know, and the lies began to come in. You know, all those problems you had as a kid, it's just because you were a troubled youth, you know. You've straightened all that out now, and here I am in a dilemma. I had no desire to drink prior to this. No obsession to drink. The thought hadn't even come into my mind. And I was in a situation where, when it did come up, I had no mental defense. I had not worked the 12 steps. I participated in AA. I was an AA member. I was active. I was making coffee. But I was not recovering from alcoholism. And when that time came, you know, I had, you know, two options. And I said, if I ask for help right now, I don't have to take this drink. And I come from a long line of people that just don't ask for help. We don't want to. We don't need anybody's help. You know, and that's the attitude. I could do this alone. And that's exactly what I did. And I remember cracking that beer, 4 years sober, saying, it's going to be okay. And I drank it down. It tasted so good. And I just was like, yes, it's going to be great. And that lasted for about 17 seconds. And the doom set in. You know, I knew I was screwed. Every lie that led up to me being able to move the world to take that drink was gone. And I, you know, this is the point where I'm supposed to say as the spiritual speaker, and then I prayed to God and everything was great, you know? Not my story, you know? Not my story. I was suffering from untreated alcoholism and I didn't know it. And I didn't know it because the things in my life were going well. I wasn't practicing the steps, and I wasn't practicing the steps with guys I sponsored. And that's the thing that makes a difference here. So I took that drink, and I got as drunk as I could to forget that I was just sober in AA. And, you know, there was no doubt in my mind I was alcoholic after I started taking that drink. And I just drank it so fast, and we were staying. This guy had given me this, like, 65-foot sailboat to stay on. Had a full bar. And the first thing I did was run back to that boat, lock the door, and just get drunk until I blacked out. I woke up in a cramped position. My legs were asleep, and I had wet the bed. And that's, you know, that's as good as it gets. That's as good as it gets. That's not like a bad night. That's as good as my drinking gets. And And I just continued to drink. I was out there for a week, and it was ugly. And the thing was, I had this was around the time of Woodstock, a 94. I had bought two tickets to go, and they sent me 14 tickets in the mail. And so I gave them out to all my friends, and I was meeting all my friends there. And but I had just taken this drink, and I got dropped off there. And it was just about sunrise, and I got dropped off about a mile away, and the sun was coming up. And I can tell you, I never felt as lonely in my life. I was just sober in AA, and I just drank, and being dropped off at this big party. And you know what? I don't want to be there. And the first thing I did when I got in the crowd was I saw the AA tent, and I went over and I talked to a couple people there, and I just told them what happened. And this guy said to me, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "I think I'm going to drink." And he says, "You know, you don't have to." I says, "I know, but I'm going to drink." And he says, "Well, I wish you the best." And and I went out, and I was in that crowd of hundreds of thousands of people, and just felt alone. And I said to myself, if I take a drink here at this place, you know, I'm going to spend probably the next 15 years upstate in New York in prison. That's just how I felt. I just knew I was so angry and so full of fear. I just hopped on a bus and I went home. And I went home and I didn't tell anybody I took a drink. I told my girlfriend. She was thrilled. You know, I remember calling her up. "Guess what happened in Milwaukee? Yeah, you know, I started drinking. I'm gonna be all right." You know, just dead silence on the phone. You know, you know, delusional to say the least. Couple of days after I came home, my father just had a heart attack and died instantly. He was 46 years old. I was working nights on a construction job. Some of my family came in and got me, and here I am. I just picked up a drink. My father died suddenly of a heart attack, and I don't know what to do, and it's ugly. And my friends in AA don't know that I drank. And I tried to come back to a meeting, and I went to a meeting that next night, and I tried to come back to a meeting, and it was like looking at my hand and not recognizing it. I walked into a meeting, and none of the feelings, none of the love of Alcoholics Anonymous that I had was present. All you people are still here, but I had no connection to you. And that's what I believe it means by this door doesn't swing both ways. You may get back to AA, but you may not get sober again. You may come here and drink time after time and say, "I'll get sober next time." But when that next time comes, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the thing that's here, you may not be able to access it. And that's the price I pay when I make decisions based on self that allow me to take a drink. So I just continue to drink. And I did spend a period of not drinking just because right after my father died, I just knew it would have got really ugly. And I drank a couple of months later, and I had the losses. You know, I had a great job in construction, and if you know anything about construction, if you get on a good job that's going to be a few years, you want to stay there. You know, so I was on this job, and they told me if I made it through Christmas, I'd be there for the next few years. Those guys were there for like 10 years. 2 days before Christmas, I go out, take a few drinks, and I don't show up again for another 6 months. And I get tired at exactly the wrong moments. I take a drink. Who knows what's going to happen? And I decide, you know what? I'm not going to work anymore. And I went back to selling drugs. And that's what I have to bring here. You know what I mean? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic before I'm anything else. But what I bring here is when I drink, I live my life in such a way that I can't do anything but sell drugs. That's the best idea I can come up with. And so that's what I went back to. And it was ugly. And I began to settle for less and less and less. And I would say, "Gee, remember when I was sober? Wasn't it so good?" And I'd say, "But that's gone." One night I had a lot of trouble and crazy stuff happened again. But it was this one night. I was out for a few days. And I remember looking down and my sock was like hanging over my shoe. It's just like sweaty and heavy, and I was just so upset. You know, I pulled the sock back up and it just fell right down again. You know, it was limp. And I was like, my sock can't even be a sock while I'm drinking, you know? It was, you know, I think the night before I got smashed in the head with a pool cue in a bar, but I wasn't upset about that, you know? The sock. And But it's those things for us, those lines that we cross ourselves. You know, the bottom for me isn't like the jackpot. It's when I can't lower my standards enough to keep up with my surroundings. And, you know, you can lower your standards and lower your standards, but, you know, eventually, you know, they just can't go any lower. And sometimes we dig our bottoms sideways, you know, and I was, you know, I was digging it side to side. And I lived in a bottom for a few years, and it was ugly. And I would tell myself, you know what, I'm okay, though. You know, I'm welcome everywhere. I'm not barred from any bars. I'm not like this guy. I'm not like that guy. And I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine, and he says, yeah, you're not welcome. Yeah, you're welcome most places, but you can't go back to my brother's place ever again. And, you know, my stomach dropped because I had no idea what he was talking about. And allegedly, you know, I... you know, we closed the bar one night and, you know, went back to his house to drink. And, you know, I don't really remember this. I don't know if it's true, but I guess they found me passed out on the toilet with my pants around my ankles, a chicken wing in my mouth, and a needle in my arm. And, like, I, you know, allegedly, I don't know, you know. And that's, and those are the good nights, you know. Those are the good nights. So... like I said, my bottom, I can't lower my standards to catch up what's going on in my life, and I'm becoming suicidal. I'm a couple of years into this relapse, and I don't know what to do. And I'm going to bed at night at first with a gun on a chair next to me, just so I feel safe. And then eventually I have to kind of hold the gun before I go to bed at night. And then eventually I'm putting the gun in my mouth at night. And it's a series of spiritual bottoms for me, and I just don't know what to do. I'm so stuck. And again, I run into somebody that I was sober with, and they said, "How you doing?" Instead of giving them the, "Oh, I'm there," no spark, no hope that I'm gonna get sober. And I don't know what to do. And my girlfriend at the time is scheduling appointments for me to see doctors, and I'm lying to them. I'm just, you know, telling them whatever they want to hear. And this one time, I saw this woman, and she was a nun who worked for Catholic Charities. And I spoke with her, and I was honest with her about everything. I told her everything that was going on in my life. And she said, "Tommy, you know, you've been sober. You know as much about Alcoholics Anonymous as I do. The only thing that's going to get in between you and this is God. The only thing that's going to make a difference here is if you beg God to make a difference." And then go back to AA and see what happens. And I went home that day, and I got down on my knees, and she told me to, like, take a shower and eat and stuff like that too. But you know, I went home and I got on my knees, and I just said, you know, "God, just please end this madness. Please end this madness." And I got up, and all they had to eat was like this dusty, rusty can of Denny Moore beef stew, you know. Cracked the lid, there's like hard fat on the top of it, you know, the good stuff. And you know, I hated it. I heated it up and I forced it down, and I took a shower and I cleaned my room up a little, and cleaned my house up a little. And I used to have this bathrobe. It was like this teal bath. I wore it like a cardigan, you know. It smelled like Doritos. And I'd wear it around the house, and you know, and I spent most of the day praying in that bathrobe for God to make my life different. And I remember I called someone up. I was like, "I think I'm gonna go to detox tomorrow." And it was for the first time I felt hopeful. And you know, the power of prayer for me is I enter a situation feeling a certain way. With myself, what I'm thinking about it, what I'm bringing to the situation is usually deranged. And I pray, and the miracle in the prayer for me is the situation that I was just thinking about is now different. Nothing has changed, but how I feel about what's going on is different. And that's the first thing that happened to me that very first day when I got down and begged God to make things different. I felt hopeless. I felt doomed. I get down on my knees. I beg God to make a difference, and it was. And the next day, God sent in, we'll say, the spiritual paratroopers. Boston Police, State Police, and DEA Drug Task Force. Seven a.m. wake up call. It was one of those. Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, you better open the door because we're gonna come through anyways, you know. And I remember we opened the door. I was like, take me, please, you know. I was a mess. But the truth was, I was relieved because I knew it was over. I knew the madness was over, From there, I went to a detox, and I was in that detox, and a lot of kids in my neighborhood, we've lost a lot of kids through this disease, and one of my best friends, my friend Sean, I got a call in the detox saying that he OD'd, and, you know, just typical, somebody left him there for dead type of thing, took everything that was worth anything, and left him face down, and I just didn't know what to do, and they let me leave the detox on like a little furlough to be a pallbearer, and I went, and you know, I don't know if I'd be here in the capacity that I am now if that didn't happen the way it did. You know, he died my first week of sobriety, and some of my closest friends, we used to hold hands crossing the street to go to school when we were like 6 years old, and it was clear to me, you know, where this brings us, and you know, I've really fought hard every day since then to do what it takes to be sober. And the first thing I was preparing for is to go to jail sober, and that's where I was at. I was caught. There was no, you know, there was no getting out of this. And I spent my first few months just preparing to be a sober AA guy that was going to jail for a couple of years. And I faced that situation, and you know, I looked up at the judge, and he says, "Son, I don't recognize you. Whatever you're doing, it looks good. Why don't we see you in another couple of months?" Went to a halfway house, stayed there, worked really hard there, and I went back, and he says, "You know," he goes, "I've never seen you in this court before. Anyways, I'm going to give you a shot." And you know, I got a really strong suspended sentence, and but the thing was, I was ready to go to jail sober. I was sober in AA now, and I was ready to go to jail and show up, and I didn't have to. And it, obviously, every day since then has been a gift, but I've really appreciated it. And I began to work really hard in AA. I found a guy in AA who had a lot of experience with the steps. He was the type of sponsor you really didn't want, though. Somebody suggested that I talk to him. Now, I didn't know that this person had also talked to him to say I was going to go looking for him. And so we were at the same meeting, and at the end of the meeting, he says, "Aren't you Tommy Delaney from Southie?" I said, "Yeah." "Weren't you supposed to see me at the beginning of the meeting?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, what are you doing? You're sponsoring yourself? What's going on here?" And, Scott just gave me 5. We're going to make it 15. He says, "What are you doing? You're sponsoring yourself?" And I says, "Well, you know, I don't know. I'm just checking things out." And he's, "Yeah, you guys from Southie can't tell you nothing, nitwit." And I says, "Well, you have so much to say, then why don't you be my sponsor?" And he said, "All right." And I really forged a wonderful relationship with this guy. He showed me what it was to show up day after day in Alcoholics Anonymous and never missed. I could never keep up with him. He got very little sleep. He ran a big union, and he helped a lot of guys in AA. I would spend a lot of time with him, and he sponsored a lot of different guys. He sponsored this one guy who was a orthopedic surgeon, and this guy was just a brilliant guy. And I was with him one time, and you know, they're kind of having some strong words with each other, and you know, and he says, "You know what? You just don't listen. You're so damn smart. You're stupid." You know, and he's talking to this guy, and he gets back in the car with me, and he says, "You know, some of the smartest people have a lot of struggles in AA." And he looked over at me, he goes, "You're going to have no problem at all." and he was right. But I just owe so much to this guy. He showed me what it was like to make a commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then the commitment is what changes all our attentions to reality. You know, showing up day after day, making time when there is no time. If I was the guy that just took from AA and never gave back, you know, I wouldn't be here today. He showed me what it was like to take care of yourself first and be able to take care of others. And that's the guy I want to be in AA. I want to be the guy who works the steps in AA with a sponsor. Therefore, I can work the steps with a sponsee. That's the guy I want to be. I want to be the person that is responsible and does owe a debt and just isn't taking up a seat in AA. When you're new, you have to come here and do nothing but take. That's all you can do. You have very little to offer except to just be a member that we can help and just absorb and take from us. You know, and then you start to give back a little. You know, and then you start to sober up and give back a little more. And you show up and things change, and hopefully you work the steps and you have some sort of experience that you can help somebody else with. And that's the guy I wanted to be. And I saw the people around me like that, and I just wanted to be that person. And what I didn't realize that, you know, in the beginning we take, but to truly receive from Alcoholics Anonymous, we have to give. We have to give to receive. And it's just so different from taking. The peace of mind that I receive from working the steps and being an active participant in AA, I've never had it. I've never had what I have from just showing up and working hard in AA. You know, it's the one thing that nobody can take away from me either. Just like that time when I went and got that high school diploma, and, you know, nobody could take that away from me. Nobody can take away the time that I put into AA. I own it. It's mine. You know, for me, I wanted to go back to school, and I wanted to do a lot of different things. And the first thing I wanted was my job back in construction, and I wasn't getting it back. And I had to deliver flowers. I got this job delivering flowers, and I was pissed. Because I would drive around Boston and see all these guys making a ton of money, construction job that I used to have, and here I am delivering flowers for minimum wage, and I'd be pissed, you know, and hi, here's your flowers, you know, delivery, so I was complaining about it with my sponsor one day, and he said, you know, Tommy, I can't think of a more perfect guy to bring people joy to their life than you. What a wonderful thing it is that you get to bring people flowers. And what do you say to that? You know, how do you complain after that? But he was right. You know, my perspective is all screwed up. And I don't know, just to kind of wrap it up, when I was younger, nobody said to each other, gee, where do you think you're going to go to college after you graduate high school, you know? There was no graduating high school. There was no plans for college. Our parents didn't have money set aside for us. If anything, they had a couple hundred for bail put in the nightstand or something. But, there was no plans like that. And I turned 30 last week. I've been sober again since April 7th of 97. And the past 14 years, I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been drunk, and I've been sober again. And, the experience I have is really tremendous. I know I have to do everything it takes. You know, there's no half measures. In the 14 years of experience that I have, doing things the way they're lined out and not doing it, it's just so valuable. But I've had a lot of great successes over the last few years, and I wanted to go get my job back in construction. And what happened was somebody gave me this other opportunity, and I ended up getting a job in a managerial capacity with construction jobs in Boston for the city of Boston, and that job led to a better job, and you know, I became a project manager in charge of a lot of different programs throughout Boston, and I have an actual career. You know, I'm in urban development and city planning, and it's just been tremendous. And but I always told myself school was reserved for other people. I don't have a college education. I never considered myself very smart, but I've proved myself wrong that I do have some intelligence, and I am capable of doing some wonderful things. And this September, I'm going to be a college freshman. And this has all come about. I you know, I met just an unbelievable girl in AA, and you know, she just has been the rock in my life, and through her successes, I've been able to look at some of my own goals, and my fiance Blue, she got accepted to two master's programs. She got thrown out of seven high schools in like 2 years, and you know, got sober and got a GED, and then went to an Ivy League women's college, and she's entering a joint master's program between Johns Hopkins and an MBA at Duke, and you know, it's just amazing, and I'm just so proud of her, and I just, you know, it was no coincidence, you know, where I am in my life. I wanted to go to school so bad, and I just felt like that was reserved for other people, and you know, the life that we live together, and she's a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we get to have a sober home, and people are welcome there, and but you know, I'm so excited to go to school. I don't feel like a 30-year-old loser going to school. I feel like a ray of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous that life can be different. And it's just by being here with you people and showing up day after day, I get to be that person. I get to be the Tommy Delaney that God always intended me to be. Like I said in the beginning, the spiritual life, you can, you know, be here as a, you know, the spiritual speaker, whatever. The spiritual life is just living a life that I believe to be true. In my inventory, I saw who I was without God. I began to set some ideals of who I wanted to be, and I had faith that I could be that person. And the faith that I had in God, by taking those steps, I began to have some spiritual experiences. And what I believe is faith is believing in something, and trusting in something is different. Trust is taking the action based on that belief. And I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I take the action, and my experience shows me that I can trust the next right thing. And you know, with you people showing up day after day, I can continue to do that. And it's just wonderful to be here, and you know, sober's better. Thank you.